Evren Farida, in this collection is Dhajagga Sutta. Dhajagga means the top of the banner, the top of the flag, or the crest of the banner. This sutta was delivered by the Buddha to monks without any request. Now, there are many suttas that were delivered by the Buddha on some occasion, or because somebody asked some question, or there was an incident and the Buddha wanted to talk about it. But this sutta is different, because Buddha just went to the place where monks were assembled and then gave this talk. Mahasatipatthana Sutta belongs to this category. So nobody asked him to talk about Mahasatipatthana, but Buddha just gave that discourse. So this sutta was also delivered by the Buddha without any request. Meaning the flag, the top of the flag. This sutta is introduced in the introductory verses as a protective sutta by just remembering which beings gain a foothold in the skies and always, even as they have a foothold on the earth. Now this refers to an incident in the olden days. It is said that once the monks were repairing a stupa, a pagoda, and so they are doing plaster work on the pagoda. Then while doing this, one monk slipped and fell from the pagoda. So when the other monk saw this, he said, "Remember the Dhajagga Sutta, remember the Dhajagga Sutta." And so that monk said to himself, "May the Dhajagga Sutta protect me," or something. And so when he said this, it is said that two pieces of brick came out and received him, or received his feet. And so he got foothold there. And then the monks threw to him ropes and creepers and then pulled him up. So when he was pulled up, then those two bricks disappeared into their former place. So just by remembering that sutta, people or beings can gain foothold in the sky or in space, just as they get foothold on the earth. In this sutta, Buddha gave to monks some means of getting rid of fear, trembling, and terror when they especially went to a forest or foot of a tree or a secluded place to practice meditation. But Buddha did not give the means, but he told them a story. So Buddha said, "Monks, long ago there was an array of a battle between the Devas and the Asuras." Now there are two kinds of beings, Devas and Asuras. Assyrians were formerly called Devas, and it is said that they occupied the place now occupied by the Devas of the 33 gods. Now, when the 33 gods were reborn in that place, by the what leader are called Asuras. Now, the leader of those that are reborn there told his followers not to drink the intoxicating drinks they were going to be served. So they did not drink. But the other former residents drank intoxicating drinks, and when they were intoxicated, the newcomers throw them down to the foot of the Mount Meru. But by the power of their karma, there appeared a new city at the foot of Mount Meru, and so the former devas went. I mean, falling down to that city, and they lived there. And when they lived there, first they did not know that it was another city, because maybe it was more or less the same. But when the tree gave flowers, they knew that it was not their place, because it was a different tree than the tree and they had in their old city. So they knew that they were deceived by the newcomers, and so they prepared to go on a battle. And it is said that in the battle among these two, although there was a battle, there was no bloodshed and no injury. No casualties. They just follow each other. Sometimes the Asuras were defeated and they would run away and then enter their city and close the city gate. So when the city gates were closed, then the Devas who were following could not do anything. So they went back. Now sometimes Devas were defeated, and they ran away, and they went into the city and closed the city gate, and then Asuras could not do anything, and so they went away. So in this way, they fight with each other maybe many times. So here Buddha said there was an array of a battle between the Devas and the Asuras. He referred to one of these battles. And these two cities came to be known as those that cannot be taken by force. So those two cities were undefeatable, impregnable, so cannot be taken by force. So when they were preparing for the battle, Sakka, the king of Devas, told the Devas, if in the battle fear or trembling or terror arises in you, then just look at the crest of my banner. So if you look at the crest of my banner, then fear, trembling and terror will disappear. If you do not happen to look at the crest of my banner, then look at the crest of another general. So he mentions three generals. So to look at the crest of the banner of three generals, and he said, if you look at the crest of the banner of these generals, then fear, trembling, and terror will disappear. And then Buddha said, the when the devas look at the crest of the banner of Shaka or the other generals, their fear, trembling or terror may or may not disappear, because Shaka himself is not free from lust, not free from ill will or anger, and not free from ignorance. He is himself subject to trembling, subject to terror, and subject to running away. So by looking at the crest of his banner, the devas may or may not lose their fear. Now, seeing the banner of one's own leader may give one courage, because one knows that the leader was there to lead them. But that is not certain and definite, because the leader himself has a nature of trembling, has a nature of terror, and has a nature of running away. And so the fear may or may not disappear by looking at the banner of these Shaka and his generals. Now, just as the king of devas gives some means of getting rid of fear to his to the devas who are his followers, Buddha gave some means of getting rid of fear in others to his disciples. So Buddha said, "I say this to you, when you have gone into a forest or to a foot of a tree or to a secluded place, and if fear or trembling or terror should arise in you, then you just remember me at the time." So Buddha said, if you are afraid, if you fear, just remember me. That means just remember my good qualities. And if you remember my good qualities, fear will disappear, and so on. And then Buddha gave the qualities of himself, qualities of Buddhas. And these qualities came to be known as 9 qualities of the Buddha. And whenever we are afraid, whenever we have fear, we just recite these 9 qualities of the Buddha. Especially during the war, when there was bombing and others, and people are afraid, they recite this, "Itibiso Bhagava," and so on. So in this formula Buddha gave what are called 9 qualities of a Buddha. The first of these qualities is that the Buddha is the worthy one. That means Buddha is worthy of gifts, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverence, worthy of respect. And the second one is that the Buddha is the fully enlightened one. And the third is that Buddha is fully endowed with vision and conduct. The fourth one is that Buddha is one who has gone rightly. And the fifth one is that Buddha is the knower of the world. Sixth, Buddha is the incomparable leader of men to be tamed, the best leader of men to be tamed. And the next is Buddha is the teacher of gods and men. And the eighth is that Buddha is enlightened, or Buddha is the Buddha. Ninth is that the Buddha is blessed. So this passage shows the qualities of the Buddha, and the commentaries explain these qualities in many different ways. It is a place where they show their skill in dissecting the words differently and then giving meaning in various ways. And so one word here may have five meanings, six meanings, and so on, so that we don't know which is the one, which is the original one. But if you understand just one, I think it is enough. So the first one is in Pali, arahant. So arahant. So Buddha is an arahant. Now arahant, the meaning of the word arahant is a worthy, one who is worthy. So worthy to accept gifts, to accept reverence, to accept homage, respect, and so on. It's very difficult how to explain all these to you. So I'll have to refer you to a book called The Path of Purification, where you can find the detailed explanation of all these qualities of the Buddha. Now I will just talk about the first one. Buddha was a worthy one. So Buddha was said to be worthy of offerings, gifts, and reverence, because he is pure. His all activities are pure. Since he is very pure, he is worthy to accept offerings and reverence. Why is he pure? Because he has eradicated all mental defilements. So since he has eradicated all mental defilements, his mind is totally pure. Since his mind is totally pure, and there is no lust in his mind, no hate, no ignorance, no pride, and so on, his mind becomes totally pure, and so he is said to be worthy of accepting gifts and others, because gifts and others offered to him bring abundant results. So Buddha is like a very fertile soil. So if you put good seeds on fertile soil, and you get abundant crops and results. In the same way, Buddha's mind is totally pure, and so whatever offerings made to the Buddha brings abundant results. Now here we must note that Buddha is referred to as an arahant. Now, there are disciples called arahants. And when we use the word arahant, we mean the disciples and not the Buddha. So the Buddha's disciples, like the Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Moggallana, and others, are called arahants. But sometimes Buddhas are also referred to as arahant. Arahant means just those who have eradicated mental defilements, or those who have reached the fourth and higher stage of enlightenment. But there is a difference between the Buddha and the arahants. Now, although both arahants And Buddha eradicate mental defilements. That is different. When Buddhas eradicate mental defilements, they eradicate mental defilements once and for all, and not even with the remaining, I mean, with the residue or a trace of mental defilements. So Buddhas eradicate mental defilements without any trace left behind. But Arahants, although they eradicate mental defilements, they are not able to get rid of what are called the residue of the mental defilements. That means some habits caused by the mental defilements. So only the Buddha can cut clean, but not the Arahants. And the story of Pilindavachara is always told in this respect. So the Venerable Pilindavachara was an Arahant, but he had the habit of addressing other people as, "Hey, wicked man, hey, wicked man." He always called like that. That was because he had been a high caste Brahmin in that life, and also in his past lives. So since he was reborn as a high caste Brahmin for 500 consecutive lives, and since he was a Brahmin in his last life, even after becoming the Arahant, he was not able to give up this habit of calling other people wicked men or outcast or something. A man was bringing some herbs to the city, and when Pilindavachara saw him, he asked him what they were, calling him a wicked man or calling him an outcast. And so the man was angry, and he said, "Oh, these are the droppings of breath." Then Pilindavachara said, so be it, or something like that. But after a while, when the man looked at his herbs, they were already turned into droppings of rats. So he told this to his friends, and his friends knew that he must have met the Venerable Pilindavachara. So his friends told him to find Pilindavachara again. And when this time he asked, he was to answer truthfully. So he went in search of Pilindavachara, and when Pilindavachara saw him, he asked him again what they were, and then this time he said, "These are herbs." So then Pilindavachara said, "Herbs they are," and then they turned back into herbs. So this is the example of how even Arahants cannot give up their habits caused by the mental defilements. But Buddhas are different, and Buddhas can eradicate mental defilements with the habits. There are other differences between Buddhas and Arahants. So some of them are Buddhas possess omniscience, but Arahants do not. And Buddhas possess the ability to understand the disposition of those listeners, so that Buddhas know what they like and what they do not like, and so Buddhas could teach to them in the way they like, so that they understand the Dharma and become enlightened. But Arahants have no such ability. And also Buddhas have the ability to see whether a person is mature enough to accept the teachings and to become enlightened. So that the ability also Arahants do not possess. So these abilities are peculiar to Buddhas. And there are many other differences. Another one difference is Buddhas had to fulfill the parami for billions and billions of lifetimes, but Arahants have shorter period of time to fulfill the necessary qualifications. Since Arahantship and Buddhahood are final destinations on the spiritual path, one who has become an Arahant will not become a Buddha. He will end his life, he will end the round of rebirth just as an Arahant. So after the death, there will be no more rebirth for him. And so Arahants will not become Buddhas or any other being. And Buddhas are also the same. So after the death, there will be no more rebirth for the Buddhas. And so the simile given in the Ratana Sutta as like this light burns out, the Arahants burn out. So it can apply to the Buddhas also. So both Buddhas and Arahants are at the end of their journey, and so there is no more rebirth for them. When we really reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, we experience joy and tranquility, and so fear and others disappear. So if we can really dwell on the attributes or good qualities of the Buddha, so we can get rid of fear. Now, like Sakya Buddha said, if you do not happen to remember me, then you remember the Dhamma or the qualities of the Dhamma. And there are said to be six qualities of the Dhamma, and and they are that the Dhamma is well expounded, that is one, and Dhamma is to be realized by oneself, or can be realized by oneself, that is the second. And the third is the Dhamma gives immediate result, is that Dhamma is worthy of the invitation, come and see. And the fifth is Dhamma is fit to be brought to oneself. And sixth is Dhamma is to be realized by the wise, each in his mind. Here also I must refer you to the Path of Purification for detailed explanation. Now the first one, that the Dhamma is well expounded. That means Dhamma is well expounded so that it is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And good in the beginning means Dhamma is good, Dhamma could give us joy and happiness and satisfaction. When we hear the Dhamma, when we study the Dhamma. Dhamma is good in the middle means when we practice it, it gives us joy and happiness. And then good in the end means after we get the results of the practice, in the middle and in the end. So Dhamma is so well expounded that even by hearing the Dhamma, or even by reading the Dhamma book, we can get joy and happiness. Those who really understand the Dhamma can experience this, the joy and happiness when they hear the Dhamma. During the time of the Buddha, there were two friends, and one friend said that Buddha gave devotees very good, and so he thought Buddha was a wise person. And the other person said, and also he asked whether what he thought about the Buddha. Then the other person said, "Who am I to evaluate the Buddha?" So only a person like the Buddha could know how great the Buddha was. And then he asked, the other person asked why he had so much praise for the Buddha. And then he answered that listening to the teachings of the Buddha gives him joy and happiness. And he gave some similes of the teachings of the Buddha. So when you have a honey cake, wherever you lick it, you get the sweet taste only. So in the same way, whatever Dhamma you hear, you get joy and happiness. And if you have a piece of sandalwood, wherever you smell it, you get the fragrant scent. So in the same way, whatever Dhamma you hear or whatever Dhamma you read, you get joy and happiness. So Dhamma can give us joy and happiness even when we listen to it, or we hear it, or we read it. When we listen to the Dhamma, or we read about the Dhamma and we understand, we experience joy and happiness. And when we practice it, we get more joy and happiness. Even when we practice just sila, keeping precepts, we know that our moral conduct is pure, and so we experience happiness. And when we practice concentration and wisdom, when we practice meditation, and we get to the stages of meditation, we experience joy and happiness. And when, hopefully, when we become enlightened, then we will experience the utmost joy and happiness. So this is what is put in the middle about the Dhamma. When a person has gained enlightenment, he can get into that state of enlightenment again and again. And when he is in that state of enlightenment, he experiences the indescribable joy and happiness. Whenever he wants to get away from suffering of mind and matter, he would go into that state of enlightenment, and like taking a vacation from dukkha, he enjoys, he experiences joy and happiness. So Dhamma is good in the middle. That means Dhamma is good when it is practiced. That sentence should be, Dhamma is good in the end. And the end means after enlightenment. So the beginning is when you hear the Dhamma, and the middle is when you practice the Dhamma, and the end is when you have gained enlightenment. So in all these three periods or stages, Dhamma gives joy and happiness. And so Dhamma is said to be good in the middle, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. If Dhamma is good in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end, it must have been because it is well expounded. So the first attribute or the first quality of Dhamma is that it is well expounded by the Buddha. Now the second quality is to be Dhamma is to be realized by oneself. That means regarding the Dhamma, the practice, you don't have to go by faith. You don't have to believe simply because Buddha taught this or your teacher said this, but you can experience it yourself, and so you can Dhamma can be realized by oneself. Now we are taught from childhood that Nama and Rupa are impermanent, and even though before we practice meditation we are saying Nama and Rupa are impermanent. But then we took it by faith. But when we practice, we really see for ourselves that Nama and Rupa come and go, they arise and disappear. And so we see for ourselves that what the Buddha said was true. So after seeing through self observation, the impermanent nature of mind and matter, we don't have to go by faith. We don't have to believe anybody at all, because we have already seen through self-experience that mind and matter are impermanent. So Dhamma has this quality that it can be realized by oneself, and it should be realized by oneself through practice. Now, Buddha said mind is impermanent, but those who do not practice meditation, who do not practice Vipassana meditation, think that mind is something like permanent. They think that they have the same mind as they had 10 years ago, or as they had when they were children. But when they practice meditation, they come to see that even for a moment, mind does not last. They see for themselves through practice that one thought comes, and then there is the mindfulness of that thought, and there is and then it goes away, and there is another thought, and another mindfulness, another thought, another mindfulness, and so on. So when they see this through experience, they cannot take mind to be permanent or even to endure for two moments. So at one moment there is one mind, and then the next moment there is another mind, and not the same mind. So this yogis see through meditation, through self-experience. Once it is seen through self-experience, then they don't have to rely on hearsay, they don't have to rely on books, or they don't have to rely on any person at all. They rely only on their experience. And something understood through self-experience is very strong, very firm. So nobody can shake them up. So Dhamma is to be realized by oneself, to be seen by oneself through self-experience, through practice of meditation. When you have realized by yourself, when you have seen the impermanence of mind and matter yourself, you want to tell other people, just come and see. Just come and practice, and you will see for yourself that mind and matter are impermanent. So Dhamma has the quality that is worthy of invitation, come and see. Since there is nothing to hide, and since there is nothing which since there is nothing rich, which is not dirty, or which is not ugly, then you can say that, come and see, come and see. So once you see for yourself the truthfulness of Dhamma, then you can invite others to come and see. So Dhamma has the attribute of invitation, come and see. Now the Buddha said, if you do not remember the Dhamma, remember the Sangha. Now Sangha is a community of noble disciples, or the community of those who have reached the stages of enlightenment. And there are nine qualities of the Sangha, and they are also explained in Visuddhimagga in detail. And they are that the order of the disciples of the Blessed One has practiced the true way. That is one quality. The order of the disciples of the Blessed One has practiced the straight way. The second, the order of the disciples of the Blessed One has practiced the way to Nirvana. And the order of the disciples of the Blessed One has practiced the proper way. So there are four now. So there are altogether eight kinds of the disciples, and they are said to be four pairs of persons, and those who have reached the first stage, second stage, third stage, and fourth stages. And these persons, the community of these persons is worthy of gifts. That is one attribute. It is worthy of hospitality. Another one. It's worthy of offerings. And it's worthy of reverential salutation. And the community of the disciples of the Buddha is an unsurpassed field, that is the best field for merit for the world. So among the nine qualities, I want to explain only one quality. That is, the order of the disciples of the Blessed One has practiced the straight way. So the straight way here means the middle way. Now, during the time of the Buddha, there were people who are trying to get rid of mental defilements. But some practice indulgence in sensual pleasures in order to get rid of mental defilements. And there are others who practice self-mortification to get rid of mental defilements. And according to the Buddha, these two ways were wrong ways, and Buddha himself followed these ways before he became the Buddha. But later, he discovered the middle way, and he practiced it himself. He got the best results of this practice, and then he taught this practice to his disciples, to all beings, for 45 years. So the disciples of the Blessed One, the disciples of the Buddha, who had gained enlightenment, are those who had practiced this middle way. And the middle way is here called the straight way. Now it is important that when we practice the correct way. If we practice the wrong way, then we will not reach our destination. And the practice of the straight way, or the practice of the middle way, is found in the Sangha. Sangha means the disciples who have reached enlightenment. So this, the practice of the middle way or the straight way, is found in the community of the noble disciples of the Buddha, and so it is one quality of the Sangha. And Buddha said, if you remember me, or if you remember the Dhamma, or if you remember the Sangha, whatever fear, trembling, or terror that would arise will disappear. And why is that? Because the Buddha is free from lust, free from anger, free from ignorance, and Buddha is without fear, without trembling, and without terror. And Buddha does not run away. So when we remember, or when we reflect upon the qualities of a person who is free from all mental defilements, and so who is free from fear and others, we gain courage ourselves, and so we are able to get rid of fear, or fear and trembling and terror disappear from our minds. So it is good to remember the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha when there is fear in us. Now the essence of this parida is the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And we can just remember these qualities and get rid of fear and so on. Or we can practice meditation on these qualities. So when we practice meditation on these qualities, it is called anusati, recollection of the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And we can practice meditation on these qualities as samatha meditation. So in order to practice samatha meditation, we first learn the meanings of the qualities, and then dwell upon these qualities again and again and again. So the qualities of the three gems are important for us, and we should remember them again and again. And especially, we should remember them when we are in fear. Now, I said that Dhamma gives us joy. Even when we just understand the Dhamma, we are joyful. And when we practice, we are joyful. And when we get the results of the practice, we are joyful. So now I want to read two verses from Dhammapada. And who has retired to a lonely abode, who has calmed his mind, and who practices vipassana on mind and matter, experiences a joy transcending that of man. Whenever he reflects on the rise and fall of the aggregates, he experiences joy and happiness. To the lonely ones, that joy and happiness is deathless. So may we experience joy and happiness through the practice of vipassana meditation, and ultimately reach the real deathless state.